in kind. Here the particular and natural form of labour, and not, as in a society based on production of commodities, its general abstract form, is the immediate social form of labour. Compulsory labour is just as properly measured by time as commodity-producing labour, but every serf knows that what he expends in the service of his lord is a definite quantity of his own personal labour-power. The tithe to be rendered to the priest is more matter of fact than his blessing. No matter, then, what we may think of the parts played by the different classes of people themselves in this society, the social relations between individuals in the performance of their labour appear at all events as their own mutual personal relations, and are not disguised under the shape of social relations between the products of labour. For an example of labour in common, or directly associated labour, we have no occasion to go back to that spontaneously developed form which we find on the threshold of the history of all civilized races. Footnote: a ridiculous presumption has latterly got abroad that common property, in its primitive form, is specifically a Slavonian or even exclusively Russian form. It is the primitive form that we can prove to have existed amongst Romans, Teutons, and Celts, and even to this day we find numerous examples, ruins though they be, in India. A more exhaustive study of Asiatic, and especially of Indian forms of common property, would show how, from the different forms of primitive common property, different forms of its dissolution have been developed. Thus, for instance, the various original types of Roman and Teutonic private property are deducible from different forms of Indian common property. Karl Marx, Zur Kritik, etc. End of footnote. We have one close at hand in the patriarchal industries of a peasant family that produces corn, cattle, yarn, linen, and clothing for home use. These different articles are, as regards the family, so many products of its labour, but as between themselves, they are not commodities. The different kinds of labour, such as tillage, cattle-tending, spinning, weaving and making clothes, which result in the various products, are in themselves, and such as they are, direct social functions, because functions of the family, which, just as much as a society based on the production of commodities, possesses a spontaneously developed system of division of labour. The distribution of the work within the family and the regulation of the labour time of the several members depend as well upon differences of age and sex as upon natural conditions varying with the seasons. The labour power of each individual, by its very nature, operates in this case merely as a definite portion of the whole labour power of the family, and therefore the measure of the expenditure of individual labour power by its duration appears here by its very nature as a social character of their labour. Let us now picture to ourselves, by way of change, a community of free individuals, carrying on their work with the means of production in common, in which the labour power of all the different individuals is consciously applied as the combined labour power of the community. All the characteristics of Robinson's labour are here repeated, but with this difference, that they are social instead of individual. Everything produced by him was exclusively the result of his own personal labour, and therefore simply an object of use for himself. The total product of our community is a social product. One portion serves as fresh means of production and remains social. But another portion is consumed by the members as means of subsistence. A distribution of this portion amongst them is consequently necessary. The mode of this distribution will vary with the productive organization of the community and the degree of historical development attained by the producers. We will assume, but merely for the sake of a parallel with the production of commodities, that the share of each individual producer in the means of subsistence is determined by his labor time. Labor time would, in that case, play a double part. Its apportionment, in accordance with a definite social plan, maintains the proper proportion between the different kinds of work to be done and the various wants of the community. On the other hand, it also serves as a measure of the portion of the common labour borne by each individual, and of his share in the part of the total product destined for individual consumption. The social relations of the individual producers, with regard both to their labour and to its products, are in this case perfectly simple and intelligible, and that with regard not only to production, but also to distribution. The religious world is but the reflex of the real world, and for a society based upon the production of commodities, in which the producers in general enter into social relations with one another by treating their products as commodities and values, whereby they reduce their individual private labour to the standard of homogeneous human labour, for such a society, Christianity, with its cultus of abstract man, more especially in its bourgeois developments, Protestantism, Deism, etc., is the most fitting form of religion. In the ancient Asiatic and other ancient modes of production, we find that the conversion of products into commodities, and therefore the conversion of men into producers of commodities, holds a subordinate place, which, however, increases in importance as the primitive communities approach nearer and nearer to their dissolution. Trading nations, properly so called, exist in the ancient world only in its interstices, like the gods of Epicurus in the Intermundia, or like Jews in the pores of Polish society. Those ancient social organisms of production are, as compared with bourgeois society, extremely simple and transparent. But they are founded either on the immature development of man individually, who has not yet severed the umbilical cord that unites him with his fellow men in a primitive tribal community, or upon direct relations of subjection. They can arise and exist only when the development of the productive power of labour has not risen beyond a low stage, and when, therefore, the social relations within the sphere of material life, between man and man, and between man and nature, are correspondingly narrow. This narrowness is reflected in the ancient worship of nature, and in the other elements of the popular religions. The religious reflex of the real world can, in any case, only then finally vanish, when the practical relations of everyday life offer to man none but perfectly intelligible and reasonable relations with regard to his fellow men and to nature. The life process of society, which is based on the process of material production, does not strip off its mystical veil until it is treated as production by freely associated men, and is consciously regulated by them in accordance with a settled plan. This, however, demands for society a certain material groundwork or set of conditions of existence, which in their turn are the spontaneous product of a long and painful process of development. Political economy has indeed analysed, however incompletely, value and its magnitude, and has discovered what lies beneath these forms. Footnote. The insufficiency of Ricardo's analysis of the magnitude of value, and his analysis is by far the best, will appear from the third and fourth books of this work. As regards value in general, it is the weak point of the classical school of political economy that it nowhere expressly and with full consciousness distinguishes between labour as it appears in the value of a product and the same labour as it appears in the use value of that product. Of course, the distinction is practically made, since this school treats labour at one time under its quantitative aspect, at another under its qualitative aspect. But it has not the least idea that when the difference between various kinds of labour is treated as purely quantitative, their qualitative unity or equality, and therefore their reduction to abstract human labour, is implied. For instance, Ricardo declares that he agrees with Destutt de Tracy in this proposition. As it is certain that our physical and moral faculties are alone our original riches, the employment of those faculties, labour of some kind, is our only original treasure, and it is always from this employment that all those things are created which we call riches. It is certain, too, that all those things only represent the labour which has created them. And if they have a value, or even two distinct values, they can only derive them from that, the value, of the labour from which they emanate. Ricardo, The Principles of Political Economy. We would here only point out that Ricardo puts his own more profound interpretation upon the words of Destutt. What the latter really says is that, on the one hand, all things which constitute wealth represent the labour that creates them, but that, on the other hand, they acquire their two different values, use value and exchange value, from the value of labour. He thus falls into the commonplace error of the vulgar economists, who assume the value of one commodity, in this case labour, in order to determine the values of the rest. But Ricardo reads him as if he had said that labour, not the value of labour, is embodied both in use value and exchange value. Nevertheless, Ricardo himself pays so little attention to the twofold character of the labour which has a twofold embodiment, that he devotes the whole of his chapter on value and riches, their distinctive properties, to a laborious examination of the trivialities of a J.B. Say. And at the finish, he is quite astonished to find that Destutt, on the one hand, agrees with him as to labour being the source of value, and on the other hand with J.B. Say as to the notion of value. End of footnote. But it has never once asked the question why labour is represented by the value of its product and labour time by the magnitude of that value. Footnote. It is one of the chief failings of classical economy that it has never succeeded, by means of its analysis of commodities, and in particular of their value, in discovering that form under which value becomes exchange value. Even Adam Smith and Ricardo, the best representatives of the school, treat the form of value as a thing of no importance, as having no connection with the inherent nature of commodities. The reason for this is not solely because their attention is entirely absorbed in the analysis of the magnitude of value. It lies deeper. The value form of the product of labour is not only the most abstract, but is also the most universal form taken by the product in bourgeois production, and stamps that production as a particular species of social production, and thereby gives it its special historical character. If, then, we treat this mode of production as one eternally fixed by nature for every state of society, we necessarily overlook that which is the differentia specifica of the value form, and consequently of the commodity form, and of its further developments, money form, capital form, etc. We consequently find that economists, who are thoroughly agreed as to labour time being the measure of the magnitude of value, have the most strange and contradictory ideas of money, the perfected form of the general equivalent. This is seen in a striking manner when they treat of banking, where the commonplace definitions of money will no longer hold water. This led to the rise of a restored mercantile system, gunya, etc., which sees in value nothing but a social form, or rather the unsubstantial ghost of that form. Once for all I may here state that by classical political economy I understand that economy which, since the time of W. Petty, has investigated the real relations of production in bourgeois society in contradistinction to vulgar economy, which deals with appearances only, ruminates without ceasing on the materials long since provided by scientific economy, and there seeks plausible explanations of the most obtrusive phenomena for bourgeois daily use, but for the rest, confines itself to systematizing in a pedantic way, and proclaiming for everlasting truths the trite ideas held by the self-complacent bourgeoisie with regard to their own world, to them the best of all possible worlds. End of footnote. These formulae, which bear it stamped upon them in unmistakable letters that they belong to a state of society in which the process of production has the mastery over man instead of being controlled by him, such formulae appear to the bourgeois intellect to be as much a self-evident necessity imposed by nature as productive labour itself. Hence, forms of social production that preceded the bourgeois form are treated by the bourgeoisie in much the same way as the fathers of the church treated pre-Christian religions. Footnote. Economists have a singular method of procedure. There are only two kinds of institutions for them, artificial and natural. The institutions of feudalism are artificial institutions. Those of the bourgeoisie are natural institutions. In this they resemble the theologians, who likewise establish two kinds of religion. Every religion which is not theirs is an invention of men, while their own is an emanation from God. Thus there has been history, but there is no longer any. Karl Marx, Misère de la philosophie, Réponse à la philosophie de la misère par Monsieur Proudhon, 1847. Truly comical is Monsieur Bastiat, who imagines that the ancient Greeks and Romans lived by plunder alone. But when people plunder for centuries, there must always be something at hand for them to seize. The objects of plunder must be continually reproduced. It would thus appear that even Greeks and Romans had some process of production, consequently an economy, which just as much constituted the material basis of their world as bourgeois economy constitutes that of our modern world. Or perhaps Bastiat means that a mode of production based on slavery is based on a system of plunder. In that case he treads on dangerous ground. If a giant thinker like Aristotle erred in his appreciation of slave labour, why should a dwarf economist like Bastiat be right in his appreciation of wage labour? I seize this opportunity of shortly answering an objection taken by a German paper in America to my work Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, 1859. In the estimation of that paper, my view that each special mode of production and the social relations corresponding to it, in short, that the economic structure of society is the real basis on which the juridical and political superstructure is raised, and to which definite social forms of thought correspond, that the mode of production determines the character of the social, political, and intellectual life generally. All this is very true for our own times, in which material interests preponderate, but not for the Middle Ages, in which Catholicism, nor for Athens and Rome, where politics reign supreme. In the first place, it strikes one as an odd thing for anyone to suppose that these well-worn phrases about the Middle Ages and the ancient world are unknown to anyone else. This much, however, is clear, that the Middle Ages could not live on Catholicism, nor the ancient world on politics. On the contrary, it is the mode in which they gained a livelihood that explains why here politics and there Catholicism played the chief part. For the rest, it requires but a slight acquaintance with the history of the Roman Republic, for example, to be aware that its secret history is the history of its landed property. On the other hand, Don Quixote long ago paid the penalty for wrongly imagining that knight-errantry was compatible with all economic forms of society. End of footnote. To what extent some economists are misled by the fetishism inherent in commodities, or by the objective appearance of the social characteristics of labour, is shown, amongst other ways, by the dull and tedious quarrel over the part played by nature in the formation of exchange value. Since exchange value is a definite social manner of expressing the amount of labour bestowed upon an object, nature has no more to do with it than it has in fixing the course of exchange. The mode of production in which the product takes the form of a commodity or is produced directly for exchange is the most general and most embryonic form of bourgeois production. It therefore makes its appearance at an early date in history, though not in the same predominating and characteristic manner as nowadays. Hence, its fetish character is comparatively easy to be seen through. But when we come to more concrete forms, even this appearance of simplicity vanishes. Whence arose the illusions of the monetary system? To it, gold and silver, when serving as money, did not represent a social relation between producers, but were natural objects with strange social properties. And modern economy, which looks down with such disdain on the monetary system, does not its superstition come out as clear as noonday whenever it treats of capital? How long is it since economy discarded the physiocratic illusion that rents grow out of the soil and not out of society? But not to anticipate, we will content ourselves with yet another example relating to the commodity form. Could commodities themselves speak, they would say, "Our use value may be a thing that interests men. It is no part of us as objects." What, however, does belong to us as objects is our value. Our natural intercourse as commodities proves it. In the eyes of each other, we are nothing but exchange values. Now listen how those commodities speak through the mouth of the economist. Value, that is, exchange value, is a property of things. Riches, that is, use value, of man. Value, in this sense, necessarily implies exchanges. Riches do not. Footnote. Observations on certain verbal disputes in political economy, particularly relating to value and to demand and supply. London, 1821. End of footnote. Riches, use value, are the attribute of men. Value is the attribute of commodities. A man or a community is rich. A pearl or a diamond is valuable. A pearl or a diamond is valuable as a pearl or a diamond. So far, no chemist has ever discovered exchange value either in a pearl or a diamond. The economic discoverers of this chemical element, who, by the by, lay special claim to critical acumen, find, however, that the use value of objects belongs to them independently of their material properties, while their value, on the other hand, forms a part of them as objects. What confirms them in this view is the peculiar circumstance that the use value of objects is realized without exchange, by means of a direct relation between the objects and man, while on the other hand, their value is realized only by exchange, that is, by means of a social process. Who fails here to call to mind our good friend Dogberry, who informs neighbour Seacole that to be a well-favoured man is the gift of fortune, but reading and writing comes by nature. Footnote. The author of Observations and S. Bailey accuse Ricardo of converting exchange value from something relative into something absolute. The opposite is the fact. He has explained the apparent relation between objects, such as diamonds and pearls, in which relation they appear as exchange values, and disclosed the true relation hidden behind the appearances, namely, their relation to each other as mere expressions of human labour. If the followers of Ricardo answer Bailey somewhat rudely, and by no means convincingly, the reason is to be sought in this: that they were unable to find in Ricardo's own works any key to the hidden relations existing between value and its form, exchange value. End of footnote. Chapter 2. Exchange. It is plain that commodities cannot go to market and make exchanges of their own account. We must, therefore, have recourse to their guardians, who are also their owners. Commodities are things, and therefore without power of resistance against man. If they are wanting in docility, he can use force. In other words, he can take possession of them. Footnote. In the 12th century, so renowned for its piety, they included amongst commodities some very delicate things. Thus a French poet of the period enumerates amongst the goods to be found in the market of Londy not only clothing, shoes, leather, agricultural implements, etc., but also femmes folles de leur corps. End of footnote. In order that these objects may enter into relation with each other as commodities, their guardians must place themselves in relation to one another, as persons whose will resides in those objects, and must behave in such a way that each does not appropriate the commodity of the other, and part with his own, except by means of an act done by mutual consent. They must, therefore, mutually recognize in each other the rights of private proprietors. This juridical relation, which thus expresses itself in a contract, whether such contract be part of a developed legal system or not, is a relation between two wills, and is but the reflex of the real economic relation between the two. It is this economic relation that determines the subject matter comprised in each such juridical act. Footnote. Proudhon begins by taking his ideal of justice, of justus eternel, from the juridical relations that correspond to the production of commodities. Thereby, it may be noted, he proves, to the consolation of all good citizens, that the production of commodities is a form of production as everlasting as justice. Then he turns round and seeks to reform the actual production of commodities, and the actual legal system corresponding thereto, in accordance with this ideal. What opinion should we have of a chemist who, instead of studying the actual laws of the molecular changes in the composition and decomposition of matter, and on that foundation solving definite problems, claimed to regulate the composition and decomposition of matter by means of the eternal ideas of naturalité and affinité? Do we really know any more about usury when we say it contradicts justice éternelle, équité éternelle, mutualité éternelle, and other vérité éternelle than the fathers of the Church did when they said it was incompatible with grâce éternelle, foi éternelle, and la volonté éternelle de Dieu? End of footnote. The persons exist for one another merely as representative of, and therefore as owners of, commodities. In the course of our investigation, we shall find, in general, that the characters who appear on the economic stage are but the personifications of the economic relations that exist between them. What chiefly distinguishes a commodity from its owner is the fact that it looks upon every other commodity as but the form of appearance of its own value. A born leveller and a cynic, it is always ready to exchange not only soul, but body, with any and every other commodity, be the same more repulsive than Mariton herself. The owner makes up for this lack in the commodity of a sense of the concrete by his own five and more senses. His commodity possesses for himself no immediate use value, otherwise he would not bring it to the market. It has use value for others, but for himself its only direct use value is that of being a depository of exchange value, and consequently a means of exchange. Footnote. For twofold is the use of every object. The one is peculiar to the object as such, the other is not, as a sandal which may be worn, and is also exchangeable. Both are uses of the sandal, for even he who exchanges the sandal for money or food he is in want of, makes use of the sandal as a sandal, but not in its natural way, for it has not been made for the sake of being exchanged. Aristoteles. End of footnote. Therefore, he makes up his mind to part with it for commodities whose value in use is of service to him. All commodities are non-use values for their owners and use values for their non-owners. Consequently, they must all change hands. But this change of hands is what constitutes their exchange, and the latter puts them in relation with each other as values and realizes them as values. Hence, commodities must be realized as values before they can be realized as use values. On the other hand, they must show that they are use values before they can be realized as values, for the labor spent upon them counts effectively only in so far as it is spent in a form that is useful for others. Whether that labour is useful for others, and its product consequently capable of satisfying the wants of others, can be proved only by the act of exchange. Every owner of a commodity wishes to part with it in exchange only for those commodities whose use value satisfies some want of his. Looked at in this way, exchange is for him simply a private transaction. On the other hand, he desires to realize the value of his commodity, to convert it into any other suitable commodity of equal value, irrespective of whether his own commodity has or has not any use value for the owner of the other. From this point of view, exchange is for him a social transaction of a general character. But one and the same set of transactions cannot be simultaneously for all owners of commodities both exclusively private and exclusively social and general. Let us look at the matter a little closer. To the owner of a commodity, every other commodity is, in regard to his own, a particular equivalent, and consequently his own commodity is the universal equivalent for all the others. But since this applies to every owner, there is, in fact, no commodity acting as universal equivalent, and the relative value of commodities possesses no general form under which they can be equated as values and have the magnitude of their values compared. So far, therefore, they do not confront each other as commodities, but only as products or use values. In their difficulties, our commodity owners think like Faust. Im Anfang war die Tat. In the beginning was the deed. Goethe, Faust. They therefore acted and transacted before they thought. Instinctively they conform to the laws imposed by the nature of commodities. They cannot bring their commodities into relation as values, and therefore as commodities, except by comparing them with some one other commodity as the universal equivalent. That we saw from the analysis of a commodity. But a particular commodity cannot become the universal equivalent except by a social act. The social action, therefore, of all other commodities sets apart the particular commodity in which they all represent their values. Thereby the bodily form of this commodity becomes the form of the socially recognized universal equivalent. To be the universal equivalent becomes, by this social process, the specific function of the commodity thus excluded by the rest. Thus it becomes money. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Revelations chapter 17, verse 13. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Revelations chapter 13, verse 17. Apocalypse. Money is a crystal formed of necessity in the course of the exchanges, whereby different products of labour are practically equated to one another, and thus by practice converted into commodities. The historical progress and extension of exchanges develops the contrast, latent in commodities, between use value and value. The necessity for giving an external expression to this contrast for the purposes of commercial intercourse urges on the establishment of an independent form of value, and finds no rest until it is once for all satisfied by the differentiation of commodities into commodities and money. At the same rate, then, as the conversion of products into commodities is being accomplished, so also is the conversion of one special commodity into money. Footnote. From this we may form an estimate of the shrewdness of the petit bourgeois socialism, which, while perpetuating the production of commodities, aims at abolishing the antagonism between money and commodities, and consequently, since money exists only by virtue of this antagonism, at abolishing money itself. We might just as well try to retain Catholicism without the Pope. End of footnote. The direct barter of products attains the elementary form of the relative expression of value in one respect, but not in another. That form is X commodity A equals Y commodity B. The form of direct barter is X use value A equals Y use value B. Footnote. So long as, instead of two distinct use values being exchanged, a chaotic mass of articles are offered as the equivalent of a single article, which is often the case with savages, even the direct barter of products is in its first infancy. End of footnote. The articles A and B, in this case, are not as yet commodities, but become so only by the act of barter. The first step made by an object of utility towards acquiring exchange value is when it forms a non-use value for its owner, and that happens when it forms a superfluous portion of some article required for his immediate wants. Objects in themselves are external to man, and consequently alienable by him. In order that this alienation may be reciprocal, it is only necessary for men, by a tacit understanding, to treat each other as private owners of those alienable objects, and, by implication, as independent individuals. But such a state of reciprocal independence has no existence in a primitive society based on property in common. Whether such a society takes the form of a patriarchal family, an ancient Indian community, or a Peruvian Inca state. The exchange of commodities, therefore, first begins on the boundaries of such communities, at their points of contact with other similar communities, or with members of the latter. So soon, however, as products once become commodities in the external relations of a community, they also, by reaction, become so in its internal intercourse. The proportions in which they are exchangeable are at first quite a matter of chance. What makes them exchangeable is the mutual desire of their owners to alienate them. Meantime, the need for foreign objects of utility gradually establishes itself. The constant repetition of exchange makes it a normal social act. In the course of time, therefore, some portion at least of the products of labour must be produced with a special view to exchange. From that moment, the distinction becomes firmly established between the utility of an object for the purposes of consumption and its utility for the purposes of exchange. Its use value becomes distinguished from its exchange value. On the other hand, the quantitative proportion in which the articles are exchangeable becomes dependent on their production itself. Custom stamps them as values with definite magnitudes. In the direct barter of products, each commodity is directly a means of exchange to its owner, and to all other persons an equivalent, but that only in so far as it has no use value for them. At this stage, therefore, the articles exchanged do not acquire a value form independent of their own use value, or of the individual needs of the exchangers. The necessity for a value form grows with the increasing number and variety of the commodities exchanged. The problem and the means of solution arise simultaneously. Commodity owners never equate their own commodities to those of others and exchange them on a large scale without different kinds of commodities belonging to different owners being exchangeable for and equated as values to one and the same special article. Such last-mentioned article, by becoming the equivalent of various other commodities, acquires at once, though within narrow limits, the character of a general social equivalent. This character comes and goes with the momentary social acts that called it into life. In turns and transiently, it attaches itself first to this and then to that commodity. But with the development of exchange, it fixes itself firmly and exclusively to particular sorts of commodities and becomes crystallized by assuming the money form. The particular kind of commodity to which it sticks is at first a matter of accident. Nevertheless, there are two circumstances whose influence is decisive. The money form attaches itself either to the most important articles of exchange from outside, and these in fact are primitive and natural forms in which the exchange value of home products finds expression, or else it attaches itself to the object of utility that forms, like cattle, the chief portion of indigenous alienable wealth. Nomad races are the first to develop the money form, because all their worldly goods consist of movable objects, and are therefore directly alienable, and because their mode of life, by continually bringing them into contact with foreign communities, solicits the exchange of products. Man has often made man himself, under the form of slaves, serve as the primitive material of money, but has never used land for that purpose. Such an idea could only spring up in a bourgeois society already well developed. It dates from the last third of the 17th century, and the first attempt to put it in practice on a national scale was made a century afterwards, during the French bourgeois revolution. In proportion as exchange bursts its local bonds, and the value of commodities more and more expands into an embodiment of human labour in the abstract, in the same proportion the character of money attaches itself to commodities that are by nature fitted to perform the social function of a universal equivalent. Those commodities are the precious metals. The truth of the proposition that, although gold and silver are not by nature money, money is by nature gold and silver, is shown by the fitness of the physical properties of these metals for the functions of money. Footnote: the metals are by their nature money. Galliani, Della Moneta, in Custodi's collection, Parte Moderna. End of footnote. Up to this point, however, we are acquainted only with one function of money, namely, to serve as the form of manifestation of the value of commodities, or as the material in which the magnitudes of their values are socially expressed. An adequate form of manifestation of value, a fit embodiment of abstract, undifferentiated, and therefore equal human labour, that material alone can be whose every sample exhibits the same uniform qualities. On the other hand, since the difference between the magnitudes of value is purely quantitative, the money commodity must be susceptible of merely quantitative differences, must therefore be divisible at will, and equally capable of being reunited. Gold and silver possess these properties by nature. The use value of the money commodity becomes twofold. In addition to its special use value as a commodity, gold, for instance, serving to stop teeth, to form the raw material of articles of luxury, etc., it acquires a formal use value, originating in its specific social function. Since all commodities are merely particular equivalents of money, the latter being their universal equivalent, they, with regard to the latter as the universal commodity, play the parts of particular commodities. We have seen that the money form is but the reflex, thrown upon one single commodity, of the value relations between all the rest. That money is a commodity is therefore a new discovery only for those who, when they analyze it, start from its fully developed shape. Footnote: silver and gold themselves, which we may call by the general name of bullion, are commodities rising and falling in value. Bullion, then, may be reckoned to be of higher value where the smaller weight will purchase the greater quantity of the product or manufacture of the country, etc. A discourse of the general notions of money trade and exchanges, as they stand in relation to each other, by a merchant, London, 1695. Silver and gold, coined or uncoined, though they are used for a measure of all other things, are no less a commodity than wine, oil, tobacco, cloth, or stuffs. A discourse concerning trade, and that in particular of the East Indies, etc., London, 1689. The stock and riches of the kingdom cannot properly be confined to money, nor ought gold and silver to be excluded from being merchandise. The East India trade, a most profitable trade, London, 1677. End of footnote. The act of exchange gives to the commodity converted into money not its value, but its specific value form. By confounding these two distinct things, some writers have been led to hold that the value of gold and silver is imaginary. Footnote: gold and silver have value as metals before they are money. Galliani. Locke says, "The universal consent of mankind gave to silver, on account of its qualities which made it suitable for money, an imaginary value." Law, on the other hand, "How could different nations give an imaginary value to any single thing, or how could this imaginary value have maintained itself?" But the following shows how little he himself understood about the matter. Silver was exchanged in proportion to the value in use it possessed, consequently in proportion to its real value. By its adoption as money, it received an additional value, une valeur additionnelle. Jean Law, Considération sur le numéraire et le commerce, in Économiste financier du 8e siècle. End of footnote. The fact that money can, in certain functions, be replaced by mere symbols of itself gave rise to that other mistaken notion, that it is itself a mere symbol. Nevertheless, under this error lurked a presentiment that the money form of an object is not an inseparable part of that object, but is simply the form under which certain social relations manifest themselves. In this sense, every commodity is a symbol, since, insofar as it is value, it is only the material envelope of the human labour spent upon it. Footnote. Money is the commodity's symbol. V. de Forbonnet, Element du Commerce, 1766. As a symbol, it is attracted by commodities. Money is a symbol of a thing and represents it. Montesquieu, Esprit des Lois, Œuvre, London, 1767. Money is not a mere symbol, for it is itself wealth. It does not represent the values, it is their equivalents. Le Trône, The Notion of Value Contemplates the Valuable Article as a Mere Symbol. The article counts not for what it is, but for what it is worth. Hegel. Lawyers started long before economists the idea that money is a mere symbol, and that the value of the precious metals is purely imaginary. This they did in the sycophantic service of the crowned heads, supporting the right of the latter to debase the coinage during the whole of the Middle Ages by the traditions of the Roman Empire and the conceptions of money to be found in the Pandects. "Let no one call into question," says an apt scholar of theirs, Philip of Valois, in a decree of 1346, "that the trade, the composition, the supply, and the power of issuing ordinances on the currency belongs exclusively to us and to our royal majesty, to fix such a rate and at such price as it shall please us and seem good to us." It was a maxim of the Roman law that the value of money was fixed by decree of the emperor. It was expressly forbidden to treat money as a commodity. However, it shall not be lawful to anyone to buy money, for, as it was created for public use, it is not permissible for it to be a commodity. Some good work on this question has been done by G. F. Pagnini, 1751, Custodi Parte Moderna. In the second part of his work, Pagnini directs his polemics especially against the lawyers. End of footnote. But if it be declared that the social characters assumed by objects, or the material forms assumed by the social qualities of labour under the regime of a definite mode of production, are mere symbols, it is in the same breath also declared that these characteristics are arbitrary fictions sanctioned by the so-called universal consent of mankind. This suited the mode of explanation in favour during the 18th century. Unable to account for the origin of the puzzling forms assumed by social relations between man and man, people sought to denude them of their strange appearance by ascribing to them a conventional origin. It has already been remarked that the equivalent form of a commodity does not imply the determination of the magnitude of its value. Therefore, although we may be aware that gold is money, and consequently directly exchangeable for all other commodities, yet that fact by no means tells how much £10, for instance, of gold is worth. Money, like every other commodity, cannot express the magnitude of its value, except relatively in other commodities. This value is determined by the labour time required for its production, and is expressed by the quantity of any other commodity that costs the same amount of labour time. Footnote. If a man can bring to London an ounce of silver out of the earth in Peru in the same time that he can produce a bushel of corn, then the one is the natural price of the other. Now, if by reason of new or more easier mines a man can procure 2 ounces of silver as easily as he formerly did one, the corn will be as cheap at 10 shillings the bushel as it was before at 5 shillings. Ceteris paribus. William Petty, A Treatise of Taxes and Contributions, London, 1667. Such quantitative determination of its relative value takes place at the source of its production by means of barter. When it steps into circulation as money, its value is already given. In the last decades of the 17th century, it had already been shown that money is a commodity, but this step marked only the infancy of the analysis. The difficulty lies not in comprehending that money is a commodity, but in discovering how, why, and by what means a commodity becomes money. Footnote. The learned Professor Rocher, after first informing us that the false definitions of money may be divided into 2 main groups, those which make it more and those which make it less than a commodity, gives us a long and very mixed catalogue of works on the nature of money, from which it appears that he has not the remotest idea of the real history of the theory. And then he moralizes thus. For the rest, it is not to be denied that most of the later economists do not bear sufficiently in mind the peculiarities that distinguish money from other commodities. It is then, after all, either more or less than a commodity. So far, the semi-mercantilist reaction of Garni is not altogether without foundation. Wilhelm Rocher, Die Grundlagen der Nationalökonomie, 3rd edition, 1858. More, less, not sufficiently, so far, not altogether. What clearness and precision of ideas and language! And such eclectic professorial twaddle is modestly baptized by Mr. Rocher, the anatomico-physiological method of political economy. One discovery, however, he must have credit for, namely, that money is a pleasant commodity. End of footnote. We have already seen, from the most elementary expression of value, X commodity A equals Y commodity B, that the object in which the magnitude of the value of another object is represented appears to have the equivalent form independently of this relation, as a social property given to it by nature. We followed up this false appearance to its final establishment, which is complete so soon as the universal equivalent form becomes identified with the bodily form of a particular commodity, and thus crystallized into the money form. What appears to happen is not that gold becomes money, in consequence of all other commodities expressing their values in it, but on the contrary, that all other commodities universally express their values in gold, because it is money. The intermediate steps of the process vanish in the result, and leave no trace behind. Commodities find their own value already completely represented, without any initiative on their part, in another commodity existing in company with them. These objects, gold and silver, just as they come out of the bowels of the earth, are forthwith the direct incarnation of all human labour. Hence the magic of money. In the form of society now under consideration, the behaviour of men in the social process of production is purely atomic. Hence their relations to each other in production assume a material character independent of their control and conscious individual action. These facts manifest themselves at first by products, as a general rule, taking the form of commodities. We have seen how the progressive development of a society of commodity producers stamps one privileged commodity with the character of money. Hence the riddle presented by money is but the riddle presented by commodities. Only it now strikes us in its most glaring form. Chapter 3. Money, or the Circulation of Commodities. Section 1. The Measure of Values. Throughout this work, I assume, for the sake of simplicity, gold as the money commodity. The first chief function of money is to supply commodities with the material for the expression of their values, or to represent their values as magnitudes of the same denomination, qualitatively equal and quantitatively comparable. It thus serves as a universal measure of value, and only by virtue of this function does gold, the equivalent commodity par excellence, become money. It is not money that renders commodities commensurable, just the contrary. It is because all commodities, as values, are realized human labor, and therefore commensurable, that their values can be measured by one and the same special commodity, and the latter be converted into the common measure of their values, that is, into money. Money as a measure of value is the phenomenal form that must of necessity be assumed by that measure of value which is immanent in commodities. Labour time. Footnote. The question, why does not money directly represent labour time, so that a piece of paper may represent, for instance, X hours labour, is at bottom the same as the question why, given the production of commodities, must products take the form of commodities? This is evident, since their taking the form of commodities implies their differentiation into commodities and money. Or, why cannot private labour, labour for the account of private individuals, be treated as its opposite, immediate social labour? I have elsewhere examined thoroughly the utopian idea of labour money in a society founded on the production of commodities. On this point I will only say further that Owen's labour money, for instance, is no more money than a ticket for the theatre. Owen presupposes directly associated labour, a form of production that is entirely inconsistent with the production of commodities. The certificate of labour is merely evidence of the part taken by the individual in the common labour, and of his right to a certain portion of the common produce destined for consumption. But it never enters into Owen's head to presuppose the production of commodities, and at the same time, by juggling with money, to try to evade the necessary conditions of that production. End of footnote. The expression of the value of a commodity in gold, X commodity A equals Y money commodity, is its money form or price. A single equation, such as 1 ton of iron equals 2 ounces of gold, now suffices to express the value of the iron in a socially valid manner. There is no longer any need for this equation to figure as a link in the chain of equations that express the values of all other commodities, because the equivalent commodity, gold, now has the character of money. The general form of relative value has resumed its original shape of simple or isolated relative value. On the other hand, the expanded expression of relative value, the endless series of equations, has now become the form peculiar to the relative value of the money commodity. The series itself, too, is now given, and has social recognition in the prices of actual commodities. We have only to read the quotations of a price list backwards to find the magnitude of the value of money expressed in all sorts of commodities. But money itself has no price. In order to put it on an equal footing with all other commodities in this respect, we should be obliged to equate it to itself as its own equivalent. The price or money form of commodities is, like their form of value generally, a form quite distinct from their palpable bodily form. It is therefore a purely ideal or mental form. Although invisible, the value of iron, linen, and corn has actual existence in these very articles. It is ideally made perceptible by their equality with gold, a relation that, so to say, exists only in their own heads. Their owner must, therefore, lend them his tongue or hang a ticket on them before their prices can be communicated to the outside world. Footnote. Savages and half-civilized races use the tongue differently. Captain Parry says of the inhabitants on the west coast of Baffin's Bay, "In this case," he refers to barter, "they licked it," the thing represented to them, "twice to their tongues, after which they seemed to consider the bargain satisfactorily concluded." In the same way, the Eastern Eskimo licked the articles they received in exchange. If the tongue is thus used in the North as the organ of appropriation, no wonder that, in the South, the stomach serves as the organ of accumulated property, and that a Kaffir estimates the wealth of a man by the size of his belly. That the Kaffirs know what they are about is shown by the following. At the same time that the official British Health Report of 1864 disclosed the deficiency of fat-forming food among a large part of the working class, a certain Dr. Harvey, not, however, the celebrated discoverer of the circulation of the blood, made a good thing by advertising recipes for reducing the superfluous fat of the bourgeoisie and aristocracy. End of footnote. Since the expression of the value of commodities in gold is a merely ideal act, we may use for this purpose imaginary or ideal money. Every trader knows that he is far from having turned his goods into money when he has expressed their value in a price or in imaginary money, and that it does not require the least bit of real gold to estimate in that metal millions of pounds worth of goods. When, therefore, money serves as a measure of value, it is employed only as imaginary or ideal money. This circumstance has given rise to the wildest theories. Footnote. See Karl Marx, Zur Kritik, etc. Theorien von der Masseinheit des Geldes. End of footnote. But although the money that performs the functions of a measure of value is only ideal money, price depends entirely upon the actual substance that is money. The value, or in other words the quantity, of human labour contained in a ton of iron is expressed in imagination by such a quantity of the money commodity as contains the same amount of labour as the iron. According, therefore, as the measure of value is gold, silver, or copper, the value of the ton of iron will be expressed by very different prices, or will be represented by very different quantities of those metals respectively. If, therefore, two different commodities, such as gold and silver, are simultaneously measures of value, all commodities have two prices, one a gold price, the other a silver price. These exist quietly side by side. So long as the ratio of the value of silver to that of gold remains unchanged, say at 15 to 1. Every change in their ratio disturbs the ratio which exists between the gold prices and the silver prices of commodities, and thus proves, by facts, that a double standard of value is inconsistent with the functions of a standard. Footnote. Wherever gold and silver have by law been made to perform the function of money, or of a measure of value side by side, it has always been tried, but in vain, to treat them as one and the same material. To assume that there is an invariable ratio between the quantities of gold and silver in which a given quantity of labour time is incorporated is to assume, in fact, that gold and silver are of one and the same material, and that a given mass of the less valuable metal, silver, is a constant fraction of a given mass of gold. From the reign of Edward III to the time of George II, the history of money in England consists of one long series of perturbations caused by the clashing of the legally fixed ratio between the values of gold and silver, with the fluctuations in their real values. At one time, gold was too high, at another, silver. The metal, that for the time being was estimated below its value, was withdrawn from circulation, mated, and exported. The ratio between the two metals was then again altered by law, but the new nominal ratio soon came into conflict again with the real one. In our own times, the slight and transient fall in the value of gold, compared with silver, which was a consequence of the Indo-Chinese demand for silver, produced on a far more extended scale in France the same phenomena, export of silver, and its expulsion from circulation by gold. During the years 1855, 1856, and 1857, the excess in France of gold imports over gold exports amounted to 41,580,000, while the excess of silver exports over silver imports was 14,704,000. In fact, in those countries in which both metals are legally measures of value, and therefore both legal tender, so that everyone has the option of paying in either metal, the metal that rises in value is at a premium, and, like every other commodity, measures its price in the overestimated metal, which alone serves in reality as the standard of value. The result of all experience and history with regard to this equation is simply that where two commodities perform by law the functions of a measure of value, in practice, one alone maintains that position. Karl Marx. End of footnote. Commodities with definite prices present themselves under the form A commodity A equals X gold, B commodity B equals Z gold, C commodity C equals Y gold, etc., where A, B, C represent definite quantities of the commodities A, B, C, and X, Z, Y definite quantities of gold. The values of these commodities are, therefore, changed in imagination into so many different quantities of gold. Hence, in spite of the confusing variety of the commodities themselves, their values become magnitudes of the same denomination, gold magnitudes. They are now capable of being compared with each other and measured, and the want becomes technically felt of comparing them with some fixed quantity of gold as a unit measure. This unit, by subsequent division into aliquot parts, becomes itself the standard or scale. Before they become money, gold, silver, and copper already possess such standard measures in their standards of weight, so that, for example, a pound weight, while serving as the unit, is on the one hand divisible into ounces, and on the other may be combined to make up hundredweights. Footnote. The peculiar circumstance that while the ounce of gold serves in England as the unit of the standard of money, the pound sterling does not form an aliquot part of it, has been explained as follows. Our coinage was originally adapted to the employment of silver only, hence an ounce of silver can always be divided into certain adequate number of pieces of coin. But as gold was introduced at a later period into a coinage adapted only to silver, an ounce of gold cannot be coined into an aliquot number of pieces. McLaren, A Sketch of the History of the Currency, London, 1858. End of footnote. It is owing to this that in all metallic currencies, the names given to the standards of money or of price were originally taken from the pre-existing names of the standards of weight. As measure of value and as standard of price, money has two entirely distinct functions to perform. It is the measure of value, inasmuch as it is the socially recognized incarnation of human labor. It is the standard of price, inasmuch as it is a fixed weight of metal. As the measure of value, it serves to convert the values of all the manifold commodities into prices, into imaginary quantities of gold. As the standard of price, it measures those quantities of gold. The measure of values measures commodities considered as values. The standard of price measures, on the contrary, quantities of gold by a unit quantity of gold, not the value of one quantity of gold by the weight of another. In order to make gold a standard of price, a certain weight must be fixed upon as the unit. In this case, as in all cases of measuring quantities of the same denomination, the establishment of an unvarying unit of measure is all important. Hence, the less the unit is subject to variation, so much the better does the standard of price fulfill its office. But only in so far as it is itself a product of labor, and therefore potentially variable in value, can gold serve as a measure of value. Footnote. With English writers, the confusion between measure of value and standard of price, standard of value, is indescribable. Their functions, as well as their names, are constantly interchanged. End of footnote. It is, in the first place, quite clear that a change in the value of gold does not in any way affect its function as a standard of price. No matter how this value varies, the proportions between the values of different quantities of the metal remain constant. However great the fall in its value, 12 ounces of gold still have 12 times the value of 1 ounce, and in prices, the only thing considered is the relation between different quantities of gold. Since, on the other hand, no rise or fall in the value of an ounce of gold can alter its weight, no alteration can take place in the weight of its aliquot parts. Thus, gold always renders the same service as an invariable standard of price, however much its value may vary. In the second place, a change in the value of gold does not interfere with its functions as a measure of value. The change affects all commodities simultaneously, and therefore, ceteris paribus, leaves their relative values inter se unaltered, although those values are now expressed in higher or lower gold prices. Just as when we estimate the value of any commodity by a definite quantity of the use value of some other commodity, so in estimating the value of the former in gold, we assume nothing more than that the production of a given quantity of gold costs, at the given period, a given amount of labour. As regards the fluctuations of prices generally, they are subject to the laws of elementary relative value investigated in a former chapter. A general rise in the prices of commodities can result only either from a rise in their values, the value of money remaining constant, or from a fall in the value of money, the values of commodities remaining constant. On the other hand, A general fall in prices can result only either from a fall in the values of commodities, the value of money remaining constant, or from a rise in the value of money, the values of commodities remaining constant. It therefore by no means follows that a rise in the value of money necessarily implies a proportional fall in the prices of commodities, or that a fall in the value of money implies a proportional rise in prices. Such change of price holds good only in the case of commodities whose value remains constant. With those, for example, whose value rises, simultaneously with and proportionally to that of money, there is no alteration in price. And if their value rise either slower or faster than that of money, the fall or rise in their prices will be determined by the difference between the change in their value and that of money, and so on. Let us now go back to the consideration of the price form. By degrees there arises a discrepancy between the current money names of the various weights of the precious metal, figuring as money, and the actual weights which those names originally represented. This discrepancy is the result of historical causes, among which the chief are 1. The importation of foreign money into an imperfectly developed community. This happened in Rome in its early days, where gold and silver coins circulated at first as foreign commodities. The names of these foreign coins never coincide with those of the indigenous weights. 2. As wealth increases, the less precious metal is thrust out by the more precious from its place as a measure of value, copper by silver, silver by gold. However much this order of sequence may be in contradiction with poetical chronology. Footnote. Moreover, it has not general historical validity. End of footnote. The word pound, for instance, was the money name given to an actual pound weight of silver. When gold replaced silver as a measure of value, the same name was applied according to the ratio between the values of silver and gold, to perhaps 1/15 of a pound of gold. The word pound, as a money name, thus becomes differentiated from the same word as a weight name. Footnote. It is thus that the pound sterling in England denotes less than 1/3 of its original weight. The pound Scot, before the Union, only 1/36. The French livre, 1/74. The Spanish maravedi, less than 1/1000. And the Portuguese rei, a still smaller fraction. End of footnote. 3. The debasing of money, carried on for centuries by kings and princes to such an extent that, of the original weights of the coins, nothing in fact remained but the names. Footnote. The coins which today are ideal are the oldest coins of every nation, and all of them were once real, and precisely because they were real, they were used for calculation. Galliani, Della Moneta. End of footnote. These historical causes convert the separation of the money name from the weight name into an established habit with the community. Since the standard of money is on the one hand purely conventional and must on the other hand find general acceptance, it is in the end regulated by law. A given weight of one of the precious metals, an ounce of gold, for instance, becomes officially divided into aliquot parts, with legally bestowed names, such as pound, dollar, etc. These aliquot parts, which thenceforth serve as units of money, are then subdivided into other aliquot parts with legal names, such as shilling, penny, etc. Footnote. David Urquhart remarks in his Familiar Words on the monstrosity that nowadays a pound sterling, which is the unit of the English standard of money, is equal to about a quarter of an ounce of gold. This is falsifying a measure, not establishing a standard. He sees in this false denomination of the weight of gold, as in everything else, the falsifying hand of civilization. End of footnote. But, both before and after these divisions are made, a definite weight of metal is the standard of metallic money. The sole alteration consists in the subdivision and denomination. The prices or quantities of gold, into which the values of commodities are ideally changed, are therefore now expressed in the names of coins, or in the legally valid names of the subdivisions of the gold standard. Hence, instead of saying, a quarter of wheat is worth an ounce of gold, we say, it is worth £3.17.10. In this way, commodities express by their prices how much they are worth, and money serves as money of account whenever it is a question of fixing the value of an article in its money form. Footnote. When Anacharsis was asked for what purposes the Greeks used money, he replied, for reckoning. End of footnote. The name of a thing is something distinct from the qualities of that thing. I know nothing of a man by knowing that his name is Jacob. In the same way, with regard to money, every trace of a value relation disappears in the names pound, dollar, franc, ducat, etc. The confusion caused by attributing a hidden meaning to these cabalistic signs is all the greater, because these money names express both the values of commodities and at the same time aliquot parts of the weight of the metal that is the standard of money. Footnote. Owing to the fact that money, when serving as the standard of price, appears under the same reckoning names as do the prices of commodities, and that therefore the sum of £3.17.10 may signify on the one hand an ounce weight of gold, and on the other the value of a ton of iron, this reckoning name of money has been called its mint price. Hence there sprang up the extraordinary notion that the value of gold is estimated in its own material, and that in contradistinction to all other commodities, its price is fixed by the state. It was erroneously thought that the giving of reckoning names to definite weights of gold is the same thing as fixing the value of those weights. Karl Marx. End of footnote. On the other hand, it is absolutely necessary that value, in order that it may be distinguished from the varied bodily forms of commodities, should assume this material and unmeaning, but at the same time purely social, form. Footnote. See Theorien von der Masseinheit des Geldes in Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, etc. The fantastic notions about raising or lowering the mint price of money by transferring to greater or smaller weights of gold or silver the names already legally appropriated to fix weights of those metals. Such notions, at least in those cases in which they aim not at clumsy financial operations against creditors, both public and private, but at economic quack remedies, have been so exhaustively treated by William Petty in his Quantulumcunque Concerning Money to the Lord Marquis of Halifax, 1682, that even his immediate followers, Sir Dudley North and John Locke, not to mention later ones, could only dilute him. If the wealth of a nation, he remarks, could be decoupled by a proclamation, it were strange that such proclamations have not long since been made by our governors. End of footnote. Price is the money name of the labour realised in a commodity. Hence the expression of the equivalence of a commodity with the sum of money constituting its price is a tautology. Footnote. Or indeed it must be admitted that a million in money is worth more than an equal value in commodities, le trône, which amounts to saying that one value is worth more than another value which is equal to it. End of footnote. Just as in general, the expression of the relative value of a commodity is a statement of the equivalence of two commodities. But although price, being the exponent of the magnitude of a commodity's value, is the exponent of its exchange ratio with money, it does not follow that the exponent of this exchange ratio is necessarily the exponent of the magnitude of the commodity's value. Suppose two equal quantities of socially necessary labour to be respectively represented by 1/4 of wheat and 2 pounds, nearly half an ounce of gold. 2 pounds is the expression in money of the magnitude of the value of the quarter of wheat, or is its price. If now circumstances allow of this price being raised to 3 pounds, or compel it to be reduced to 1 pound, then although 1 pound and 3 pounds may be too small or too great properly to express the magnitude of the wheat's value, nevertheless they are its prices, for they are, in the first place, the form under which its value appears, that is, money, and in the second place, the exponents of its exchange ratio with money. If the conditions of production, in other words, if the productive power of labour, remain constant, the same amount of social labour time must, both before and after the change in price, be expended in the reproduction of a quarter of wheat. This circumstance depends neither on the will of the wheat producer, nor on that of the owners of other commodities. Magnitude of value expresses a relation of social production. It expresses the connection that necessarily exists between a certain article and the portion of the total labour time of society required to produce it. As soon as the magnitude of value is converted into price, the above necessary relation takes the shape of a more or less accidental exchange ratio between a single commodity and another, the money commodity. But this exchange ratio may express either the real magnitude of that commodity's value, or the quantity of gold deviating from that value, for which, according to circumstances, it may be parted with. The possibility, therefore, of quantitative incongruity between price and magnitude of value, or the deviation of the former from the latter, is inherent in the price form itself. This is no defect, but on the contrary, admirably adapts the price form to a mode of production whose inherent laws impose themselves only as the mean of apparently lawless irregularities that compensate one another. The price form, however, is not only compatible with the possibility of a quantitative incongruity between magnitude of value and price, that is, between the former and its expression in money, but it may also conceal a qualitative inconsistency, so much so that although money is nothing but the value form of commodities, price ceases altogether to express value. Objects that in themselves are no commodities, such as conscience, honour, etc., are capable of being offered for sale by their holders, and of thus acquiring, through their price, the form of commodities. Hence, an object may have a price without having a value. The price in that case is imaginary, like certain quantities in mathematics. On the other hand, the imaginary price form may sometimes conceal either a direct or indirect real value relation. For instance, the price of uncultivated land, which is without value, because no human labour has been incorporated in it. Price, like relative value in general, expresses the value of a commodity, for example a ton of iron, by stating that a given quantity of the equivalent, for example an ounce of gold, is directly exchangeable for iron. But it by no means states the converse, that iron, is directly exchangeable for gold. In order, therefore, that a commodity may in practice act effectively as exchange value, it must quit its bodily shape, must transform itself from mere imaginary into real gold. Although to the commodity such transubstantiation may be more difficult than to the Hegelian concept, the transition from necessity to freedom, or to a lobster, the casting of his shell, or to St. Jerome, the putting off of the old Adam. Footnote. Jerome had to wrestle hard not only in his youth with the bodily flesh, and by his fight in the desert with the handsome women of his imagination, but also in his old age with the spiritual flesh. "I thought," he says, "I was in the spirit before the judge of the universe." "Who art thou?" asked a voice. "I am a Christian." "Thou liest," thundered back the great judge. "Thou art naught but a Ciceronian." End of footnote. Though a commodity may, side by side with its actual form, iron, for instance, take in our imagination,